Let's continue today with the story of the coup of Prince Absalom and David's evacuation of Jerusalem of all his supporters there. We're going to pick up at 2 Samuel 15:32. This is what we know so far. David gets this word of the coup going on down at Hebron, probably later in that same day that it happened, because a runner or a rider has come to him with the news. And so he immediately calls for as many people as possible, especially his major supporters, to leave the city of Jerusalem, cross the Kidron, and then head north and east over the Mount of Olives and then down into the Jordan Valley to the crossing of the Jordan near Jericho. Now, David and his people have the Ark of the Covenant with them at first as the city is being evacuated. But David orders the two priests to take the Ark of God back into the city. He basically says, if God wants me to come back, great. But if this is all because of God wanting me gone, that's fine. That's the way it's going to have to be. But the Ark of God needs to stay at the capital city. God's throne needs to stay at the capital city. So that's already been taken care of. David, though, gets news up at the top of the Mount of Olives, somewhere near where Jesus ascended, is where this is all taking place. There's a worship site that's been placed there. He gets news that one of his chief advisors, one of his wisest counselors, has joined the Absalom coup. He's one of the coup plotters. And he prays to God right there, God, make his counsel foolishness. Now, he gets a sort of answer to his prayer when another one of his counselors shows up. And that's where we take up the story. Verse 32, 2 Samuel 15, while David was coming to the summit where God was worshipped, behold, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat torn and dirt on his head. So he has just caught up with the king's entourage after becoming aware of the coup, and he is also showing his grief over what's happening. So he's ripped his coat, he's put dirt up on his head. And David says to him, if you go with me, you'll be a burden to me. Now, he's not being rude. He's being pragmatic. Effectively, he says, if you accompany us, you'll just be another mouth to feed while we're on the run. I've got a different idea for you. Verse 34, but if you return to the city, and then you say to Absalom, I'll be your servant, O king, as I've been your father's servant in time past, so now I will be your servant. Then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. So if you'll go back in and indicate that you are on Absalom's side, that you want to help him out, that you convince him that you want to be part of the coup, you can be my inside guy there. And you can make sure that Absalom doesn't follow Ahithophel's good advice. Verse 35, are not Zadok and Abiathar, the priests, with you there? So you'll have the two priests on your side. They're already staying. They're going to be my guys there too. So whatever you hear from the king's house, you tell it to Zadok and Abiathar, the priests. And behold, their two sons are there with him, Ahimaaz, Zadok's son, and Jonathan, Abiathar's son. By them you shall send to me everything you hear. So he now says, your You're the anchor guy. You're the one that's going to help us. You're going to get the inside track of what's going to happen as soon as Absalom arrives on the scene. Once you get those details, I want you to take that information to the two priests. The two priests will give it to their two sons. Those two sons have instructions to get out of town and get down to the fords of the Jordan as fast as they can go and let us know what to expect next in this coup. So this is a very precarious situation here. It's all taking place in real time. It's all taking place in a very short period of time in order to help David have a sense of what to do next. Verse number 37. So Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom was entering Jerusalem. So this evacuation may have taken place overnight, maybe into the beginning of the next day. And so Absalom and his people have traveled perhaps as early as possible the following day, and they're just arriving as Hushai comes back into the city, and David and his people have crested the Mount of Olives, and they're heading down into the valley of the Jordan. Verse 1 of chapter 16. When David had passed a little beyond the summit, Ziba, the servant of Merib-Baal, remember this is the son of Jonathan. His name here, Mephibosheth, is not his circumcised name. This is a name substitution from a long time after the story actually took place. It's all because the later scribes hated to write the name Baal in any positive form in a text. But in the time of David, Baal was the Canaanite word used to refer to God. It was a parallel. It was a synonym for he who is. And so Merib-Baal actually meant he who is that gives justice, that gives judgment. So it was a positive name back at this time. But anyway, you remember that David had sought out Merib-Baal and basically adopted him as another son, gave him all the property that belonged to his grandfather and his father, and made Ziba his servant to take care of all that property. And Merib-Baal was to stay at the palace in Jerusalem and be like one of the king's sons. Well, for whatever reason, Merib-Baal was not at the palace when all of this started. He was somewhere else. And so Ziba shows up here on the northeast side of the Mount of Olives, heading down the road from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And he's got supplies for David and the evacuees. Says he came with a couple of donkeys saddled, bearing 200 loaves of bread, 100 bunches of raisins, 100 of summer fruits, and a skin of wine. The king said to him, "Why have you brought these?" And Ziba answered, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who faint in the wilderness to drink." So they're to help you in your evacuation. The king then said, "Where is your master's son?" Meaning Merib-Baal, because Ziba started out as Saul's servant. And so Jonathan is Saul's son, and then Merib-Baal is his son. And so this is basically, so where's your master's son or grandson? Well, Ziba said to the king, "Behold, he remains in Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today the house of Israel will give me back the kingdom of my father.'" Now, I want to just break in here and be very frank with you. In my opinion, I believe Ziba is lying through his teeth. I don't trust a word that's coming out of his mouth. I never have trusted him. You remember that he had complete control of all of the possessions and properties left behind by the death of King Saul and all of the princes like Jonathan. And so he was like a very wealthy and powerful person until David sought out Meribaal, brought him to Jerusalem, and declared that all of the properties then controlled by Ziba were the rightful possession of Meribaal, and that now Ziba had to do things as the servant of Meribaal. So I believe that Ziba has hated that situation ever since David did it. It's been quite a few years by now. This gave him the opportunity to seize back control, because if he could convince David that Meribaal was a traitor, an ingrateful person, then David would give him control back. And that part will actually work for him, as we'll see in just a moment. But I want you to just pause with me and think about this. Ziba's explanation that why Meribaal was not there with him on the Mount of Olives is because he believed that by staying behind in Jerusalem, he'd get his kingdom. Why? Why would Absalom give a kingdom to a person from Saul's kingdom who is crippled in his feet? Why? There's no reasonableness to that concept. I mean, Absalom is carrying out a coup against his own father. There's every indication he intended to kill his father. So why would he be kind and hand over the kingdom to a crippled member of the Saul family? It does not compute. But Ziba portrays that as the lie, and David, perhaps in his pessimistic and depressed mode, accepts it at face value. So the king said to Ziba, "Behold, all that belonged to Meribaal is now yours." So he gives him control of the properties again for himself. And Ziba said, "I pay homage. Let me ever find favor in your sight, my lord the king." And so, again, my opinion, and that's all it's worth, is that Ziba is playing the odds here. He believes, and I think he's correct in his belief, he believes that David will be able to pull together a defensive force and come back and defeat Absalom's coup and be back on the throne in Jerusalem. I think Ziba is betting on that, and I think he's correct. In fact, we know he's correct. But he also bet on the idea that if he portrayed Meribaal as a betrayer, as an ingrate, that David would become angry and cut him off. And so that's kind of paid off as well. We'll see how it all shakes out later. Verse number 5. When King David came to Bahurim, somewhere on the road toward Jericho, there came out a man of the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimei. This is going to be some sort of cousin, probably, of Meribaal, the son of Gera. And as he came, he cursed continually. Now, he's not walking along with a foul mouth. He is calling the wrath of God down upon David. he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David. So he's probably up on a hillside that's over the road. And he's throwing rocks, he's throwing dirt clods, whatever he can get. And he is calling God's judgment down on David. All the people, all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. And Shimei said as he cursed, "Get out! Get out, you man of blood, you worthless man! He who is has avenged on you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you've reigned, and he who is has given the kingdom into the hand of your son Absalom. See, your evil is on you, for you are a man of blood." So he believes and is expressing that belief that David is a murderer of the Saul household, that he is an illicit king, that he seized it by whatever means. Apparently he thinks he seized it by that was illicit. And he thinks that God is bringing judgment down on David. And so he's calling the wrath of God down. Verse number 9, doesn't surprise us. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, this is David's nephew, the son of his older aunt, his mom's older sister, his older sister's son. There we go. Somewhere probably close to his age, one of his military leaders. "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head." Now, he's always offering to take off people's heads. He offered to take off Saul's head, you remember. But the king said, "What have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah?" Notice the plural here, because David's not just thinking about Abishai, he's thinking about Joab, another one of his commanders. These guys have been trouble for David for a good long time. So, why am I still dealing with you guys? If he is cursing because he who is has said to him, "Curse David," who then shall say, "Why have you done so?" So, another evidence that David feels that maybe he's brought this on himself. If what he's saying is because God wants him to say it, who am I, who are you to stop him from saying these things? Then David said to Abishai and to all his servants, "Behold, my own son seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite?" So, why should we be surprised? My own boy is trying to kill me. Why wouldn't a Benjamite, a relative of the late King Saul, the late Prince Jonathan, the late Prince Ishbael, all of these who are dead, why wouldn't one of their relatives think it would be a good idea for me to be dead? Leave him alone. Let him curse, for he who is has told him to. So you can hear there, David actually believes that God is doing this. Now, that is not the case, but it most certainly is a natural outgrowth from a lot of the things that he has done since his adultery with Bathsheba. Verse number 12. It may be that he who is will look on the wrong done to me, and that he who is will repay me with good for his cursing today. So he does offer this positivity. Maybe God will look at the nasty things he's saying and then do the opposite. Maybe God will bring me back and make things better again. So David and his men went on the road while Shimei went along on the hillside opposite him, cursed him as he went, threw stones at him and flung dirt or dust. So, all of this happening in a very short period of time. during the evacuation. And so the king and all the people who were with him, they arrived weary at the Jordan, and there he refreshed himself. So I think they all arrive at the crossings of the Jordan River near Jericho on the second day after the actual coup took place at Hebron. Verse 15. Now we have to go back to when Absalom just arrived at the city of Jerusalem. He arrives shortly after David goes up and over the crest of the Mount of Olives. So probably in the morning time is what my guess is. Now Absalom and all the people, the men of Israel, came to Jerusalem, and Ahithophel with him. That's the counselor who threw in with Absalom and basically betrayed David. When Hushai, the Archite, David's friend, came to Absalom, Hushai said to Absalom, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" So he greets Absalom as the new king. Absalom said to Hushai, "Is this your loyalty to your friend?" Now, maybe we need to think a little bit about some ages going on here. This is happening, I believe, probably around the 36th year of David's time on the throne. In fact, it may be at the very beginning of his 36th year. So that would make David somewhere around 66, 65, 66, somewhere in that neighborhood. Absalom would have been born probably in the second year of David down at Hebron. So he's basically in his early 30s still. Hushai has probably watched Absalom grow up. And that means Absalom has seen Hushai be David's counselor all this time. And now, when he just shows up voluntarily, because he wasn't part of the original coup. See, Absalom actually talked to Ahithophel and convinced him to become part of the coup. He was one of the plotters. He was one of the inside guys. But Hushai was on the outside. He was not looked at as a potential coup participant. But now he's shown up here on his own, basically saying, "Long live King Absalom." And Absalom's response is, "So is that how you're going to pay back my father for all of that relationship that you two have had?" And so Hushai said to Absalom, "No. For whom he who is and this people and all the men of Israel have chosen, his I will be, and with him I will remain." So he's already thought this through. He says, "Absalom, I am here to serve the will of God and the people. And that is you being king. Because here you are at Jerusalem getting ready to sit on the throne." Verse 19, and again, "Whom should I serve? Should it not be his son?" So, "I've served your father as king. Why wouldn't I serve you as the prince, becoming the king?" And honestly, we already know Absalom was the crown prince. He was the next one in line for the throne. So, Hushai is actually working on a concept that is not too far afield from what would have happened if David had died of natural causes. And that is, Hushai would have served Absalom next. Verse number 20, "Then Absalom said to Ahithophel," give your counselor a counsel, what should we do? So now it's been settled, Hushai is part of the advising council to King Absalom. And so Absalom now starts asking for recommendations. And he talks to Ahithophel because Ahithophel is the top advisor. So this is the advice that he gives him. And it is related to a prophecy that was made back at the time of the adultery revelation with Bathsheba and David. Ahithophel said to Absalom, "Go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you have made yourself a stench to your father, and the hands of all who are with you will be strengthened." So his advice is, you need to make it very clear there is no coming back from this, that you are severing every tie with your father. So the 10 concubines that he left behind, you need to go in and claim them as your own. And the way that they would do that is some sort of intimate sexual contact. And it, in this case, it's going to be a very brief intimate sexual contact for him to go through all 10 of these women in a very brief moment of time. Because in ancient Middle Eastern culture, the new king took over the household of the old king. And that included wives and concubines. So what did they do? Verse 22, they pitched a tent for Absalom on the roof, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. So there was a modicum of privacy, but it is obvious to everybody what he does. He walks into the tent with one concubine at a time, has some sort of intimate sexual contact with her, comes back out, does it again with another one, and by this, he makes it clear to everybody, I'm the new king, I'm taking over from where my father was, and my father and I are never going to be reconciled. And so verse 23, in those days, the counsel that Ahithophel gave was as if one consulted the word of God. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel esteemed both by David and by Absalom.